Ramon Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. We already know that here in SoCal, fire season is year-round, but now we're entering our peak danger period. High winds, low humidity, and dry vegetation could mean our electricity gets unplugged. Plus, ever wonder why you don't hear anything anymore about the hole in the ozone layer?
This is one of the most successful cases of scientists and governments really working together.
Hear that? It is possible. Find out what else can work on Take Two. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Wasn't it just Friday? It just seemed like it was just Friday a second ago. But thanks for kicking off your week with us anyway. Later on the show, we're going to find out more about Caltrans' plan to make the Arroyo Seco Parkway safer for drivers. The state's Department of Transportation is considering five alternatives, including a speed reduction along the 110 freeway's historic stretch. By the way, one of the options is do nothing, absolutely nothing, really. We're going to get into that coming up in just a bit. Also, after last week's Covering Climate Now, we got a whole lot of questions from listeners, so many that they actually overflowed into this week. Now, lucky for us, we've got Caltech right down the street, so we called up some researchers there, and they're going to answer all of them. More on that about 40 minutes from now. So we're going to start today, though, with power utilities and wildfires. Senate winds are forecast to blow through L.A. and Ventura starting tonight, bringing warm, dry air to a region vulnerable to wildfires. Similar weather conditions up in Northern California, prompting the major electricity provider up there, PG&E, to shut off power to 21,000 customers tonight. Now, down here, SoCal Edison says it's monitoring the situation, and if conditions worsen, it might do the same for about 10,000 customers. It's all part of a statewide program where power companies will flip off the switch in certain areas to make sure utility lines down by fierce winds don't spark a wildfire. Here to remind you how it all works, and to help prepare you if indeed the power does go out, we have Robert Villegas, spokesperson for SoCal Edison. Welcome.
Good to be with you.
Now, there is no scheduled shutoff for Southern California right now, but the areas you're watching include large swaths of San Bernardino County, as well as rural unincorporated places of L.A., Riverside, and Santa Barbara counties near mountain areas. In general, Robert, what are the places in SoCal more likely to experience a shutoff than others?
Well, I can tell you that about a quarter of our service territory, we serve 50,000 square miles, about a quarter of that is considered high fire risk. The circuits that are in high fire risk areas, some of them are downstream from the foothills and the mountains. But as you can imagine, because of the vegetation situation, urban interface, wildland interface areas are always at risk due to vegetation and, of course, the danger to homes, as well as wind-driven potential fires that are wind-driven in the foothills and at the base of the mountains and in the mountains themselves.
Now, what types of conditions would trigger a shutoff?
We look at the vegetation that's in areas where our infrastructure is to determine how dry it is, how likely it is to burn. We're monitoring for relative humidity in the air in the vegetation. We look at the amount of vegetation in an area. And then we also, of course, we have our own meteorologists in-house that look very specifically at the weather in areas of the territory where we have power lines and other infrastructure to get that local forecast as close to those areas and take all of that into consideration before we would turn off the power to a circuit.
You know, a power shutoff might seem like an inconvenience to people, but it's an issue that you do not take lightly. What's the worst case scenario if power companies didn't preemptively shut off power because of cutting winds or torrential rains?
What we saw in the last 2 years in terms of fires in Northern California and here in Southern California have shown us that is the worst case scenario that could devastate entire communities, homes, lives could be lost. And so, you know, we take it very, very seriously that we only do this when it's absolutely necessary.
Now, if it should come to that, Robert, how will you alert customers to a shutoff? And generally, how long could they last?
Well, you know, what we do is we strive to provide more than 24-hour notice where possible. Customers can sign up to receive alerts at SEE.com/PSPS. public safety power shutoff, and they can sign up to receive alerts should their circuit be impacted. And then once we notify customers, we'll continue to notify them and provide them updates every 24 hours. Before we can restore power, first we would let the weather event pass. That could be a matter of hours or maybe a half a day. And then once that happens, we would go out and inspect the circuit that was turned off to ensure that there's no damage and that it is safe to turn on.
We're talking to Robert Villegas, spokesperson for SoCal Edison, about the power shutoff program. Now, preparing for a few days without power can be a little tough, a little tricky. What are some things that you might recommend to people that they store in their power off kits, considering that you might be notifying people through some kind of electronic device?
Well, you definitely need to have some supplies, water, food, medicine, batteries to charge your devices. But definitely number one is having the plan. And having that plan ahead of time.
Say I see a down power line, or say I have, as you mentioned, an elderly relative that needs medical attention during the shutoff. What can I do to prepare if I still need to reach the right authorities for something like that?
You know, the most important thing is not to approach any damaged electrical equipment. Even if it looks as though there's no sparks, you're not hearing any humming, don't be fooled, don't be lulled into complacency. Those lines can still be live. So it's very important to call 911, and the 911 operators will actually dispatch our troublemen out to the field themselves.
All right, now this season would be the first real test of this new program between you and other utilities in the state. Afterwards, Robert, what would you like to hear from the public on how to make it even better?
What I would like to hear is that the public has seen that this is a reality that we are facing and has taken steps to prepare well in advance. Typically, what we see is we have an event like the earthquake that we experienced in Ridgecrest, and that, you know, sort of provides a level of consciousness for people for a week or a month or two. And then, we push that to the back of our mind as day-to-day concerns take over. What we want people to understand is go ahead and sign up and be ready and be planned and prepared.
That's Robert Villegas, spokesperson for SoCal Edison. Robert, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All right, moving on. Last night may have marked a new era in Emmy history. The awards show suffered a 23% drop in viewership from last year's telecast, a new all-time low. Plus, for both primetime and creative arts Emmys, cable and streaming shows took home 86% of the trophies, leaving just 14% to traditional broadcast programming. But it wasn't all bad news. A lot of the winners marked historical victories and powerful moments for last night's award show. John Horn, host of The Frame, KPCC's Arts and Culture program, is here to break it all down. Hello, John.
Hey, Abe.
All right, before we get to the winners and the losers, the show was something that people weren't that tuned into, apparently.
Just a little bit. Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people, maybe yourself, were watching some football.
I switched. I went back and forth.
Previous button. It was a pretty good game, yeah. Browns, Rams. But I think the more important issue is this is a network television broadcast on Fox about shows that have nothing to do with network television. So it's like you go to your favorite steakhouse and all they're serving are vegan entrees. If you are used to watching broadcast network TV and you watched the Emmys, you wouldn't recognize any of these shows because throughout the entire evening of the primetime Emmys, two trophies were won by a network, and that was NBC that won two awards for Saturday Night Live. Everything else was either streaming service, premium cable channel like HBO, or a basic cable channel.
See that? That's why you're here, John. You make those connections. I didn't think of that. I didn't even make that connection. But it's absolutely right. Yeah. All right, so let's get to the surprise big winner of the night, and that's Fleabag.
The only thing harder than having to tell your super high-powered, perfect, anorexic, rich super sister that you've run out of money is having to ask her to bail you out. I'm just going to ask her. I'm just going to come.
Do you need to borrow money?
No.
The Phoebe Waller-Bridge comedy took home four awards last night, including Outstanding Comedy Series. John, was this a surprise?
I think it was a good surprise. It wasn't like Green Book beating Roma for the Best Picture Academy Awards where you go, what? Because this is a good show. I mean, not that Green Book has its admirers, but Fleabag is a really good show. I think a lot of people thought it could have gone to another show like Veep. Fleabag is an Amazon series. It was first on in 2016, so it went away for a while. It is a very good show. You need to check it out. It stars and is created by Phoebe Waller-Bridge. There are some devices where she speaks as a character, and the character's name is Fleabag, directly into the camera. There are all these great asides. It is about a woman who makes a number of bad choices, some of which she's accountable for and some of which she kind of pushes to the corner of her life. It's really a good show. But it started winning early and often. Yeah. And I think you could tell as you were flipping back and forth from the football game that it was going to be a big night for Fleabag.
Yeah, and this is one of those things where everyone wonders, okay, what's the value of these awards and what do they do? I've heard of Fleabag. I've heard people talk glowingly about it. But now I'm actually going to put it at the top of the next to watch on my list.
I think that's exactly what the Emmys can do. Like Game of Thrones, like, are people going to go back and start at the beginning? Because I thought, wow, Peter Dinklage at one drama series. No. And this is where I think Emmys and Academy Awards and Grammys, Tonys can actually call attention to a show that you need to check out. There are almost 500 scripted shows on TV right now, if you count everything that's on cable and streaming services. So it's very hard for shows to rise above, all of the riffraff. And Fleabag is a show that I hope will benefit. Unfortunately, they say it's done. It's only going to be 2 seasons.
What?
But those 2 seasons start at the beginning. At the end of the first season, you will say to yourself, there's no way they can make a second season out of this because the first season ends so well, but they did.
All right, so let's move on now to another big winner and pivotal moment during the ceremony.
I see this as an acknowledgement of what is possible when a woman is trusted to discern her own needs, feels safe enough to voice them, and respected enough that they'll be heard. And so I want to say thank you so much to FX and to Fox 21 Studios for supporting me completely and for paying me equally.
That's from Michelle Williams' acceptance speech for Best Actress in a Limited Series, Fosse Verdon. This was probably one of the most powerful moments of the entire night, it sounds like.
Yeah, and she's speaking from some experience. You might remember a movie called All the Money in the World about J. Paul Getty. Kevin Spacey was in that film. They finished it, and then Kevin Spacey had some, sexual harassment and assault problems. So they recast the role with Christopher Plummer, and they went back to reshoot it. Michelle Williams came back and worked for less than $1,000. Mark Wahlberg came back and worked for $1.5 million. So you tell me if there's a big difference. And Michelle Williams isn't just talking about herself. She's talking about pay equity and how women are paid less, not just in Hollywood, but in almost every walk of life. And because they didn't have a host this year, I think they weren't as eager to play off winners who maybe went on a little bit long in their acceptance speeches. And I think that was one of the results. You get to hear Michelle Williams talking about something that's a real issue, not just in Hollywood, but around the world.
Another big moment of the night was Billy Porter's win for the show Pose. Why did this win have so much weight?
Well, there are a couple reasons why. And I think you can step back and say in the larger awards world, it's very important for an openly gay Black man to win an award like Billy Porter did. And I think it's also important because, again, this is a non-network show. It's on FX. This is an important show about a community that not a lot of people have encountered. And I think it's worth, again, this is a show that maybe will get some attention based on its win at the Emmys. I mean, this is an actor who's already won a Grammy. He's already won a Tony. He's not a new face, but he's a new face on television. So now if he wins his Academy Award, he can have the, EGOT?
Yes. EGOT. I'm still working on.
Okay. EGOT,
yeah. All right, now, another big winner of the night, Game of Thrones. The series concluded its 8th and final season this year, took home 2 awards last night, including Outstanding Drama. Kind of surprising, considering its final season wasn't exactly received too well by critics or any human beings.
This is like something I read once about wine. Like, if you look at wine ratings, every wine is like an 87 or a 92. Like, nothing's ever a 50. And I remember reading one wine critic who gives every bottle of wine an 80 just for being a bottle of wine.
Just for showing up.
And it feels like that happened with Game of Thrones. And oddly enough, Veep, which also had its last season, which was a great last season, didn't win. That's where the Fleabag Award went. Nobody seemed to really think that it was the best season for Game of Thrones. It felt like, again, you've got thousands of Emmy voters. We'll just check that thing. I heard it was okay. We're going to thank it for being around and changing television. But Peter Dinklage, who won an acting award for it, is the only actor who's won an acting award for Game of Thrones. So it has succeeded very much at the Emmys without its cast being recognized, Peter Dinklage being kind of the only person who's been singled out.
Frame coming up today at 3:30. Give us a sneak peek of the Emmy coverage.
I mean, I think we're going to talk about whether or not network television can compete in the Emmys. Are they out of it completely, or are they going to have to change their game if they want to be players at next year's show or any show in the future?
That's John Horn, host of KPCC's Arts and Culture show, The Frame, coming up today at 3:30. John, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The 110 freeway between Pasadena and the 5 is one unique stretch of road. It's beautiful, scenic, really twisty, which, while it can make the drive fun, it can also make it really dangerous, especially if you're trying to enter or exit the freeway. That is definitely not the fun part of the 110. Coming up, Caltrans, though, might give the Pasadena freeway a little nip and tuck. We'll find out what they might plan to do when Take 2 continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. This fall, California State University campuses begin the second year of a major overhaul of their freshman classes. Cal State did away with remedial classes and is placing students who need help into new classes they hope will lead to more students to earn their degrees quicker. Some campuses say last year was a success, so KPCC's Adolfo Guzman Lopez went back to college to find out what's in the secret sauce.
This is Math 104 at Cal State Long Beach.
If you have to write one half, but in a denominator of 5, what would it be?
Professor Jen Mei Chin launches into complex fractions. It's a 126-student class in an auditorium. She doesn't lecture behind the podium. She moves up and down the aisle, skipping two steps at a time, like a daytime talk show host with a wireless mic.
Yeah, do you guys agree?
We really want to focus on developing their reasoning skills, communications, and problem solving in general.
Under the old approach, about 1/4 of the students in this class would have been labeled remedial, a term Cal State doesn't use anymore. That approach assumed remedial students weren't sufficiently prepared in high school. The new approach assumes these students can do college-level work if they're taught by engaging professors and receive individualized help. Administrators here say the approach is leading to more aha moments in the classroom.
How many steps do you need to take to get to 17?
Two
as well, but except the step sizes are different.
Oh, okay.
Math instruction is a hard nut to crack for some campuses. Some students say their high school classes were mostly about memorizing formulas and listening to teachers lecture.
Math has never been a strong subject point for me. It just doesn't click for me.
Sarah Martinet took Chin's class last year and said Chin made math seem less abstract.
It was more of a practical approach to math, like math you could use throughout your daily life.
Cal State Chancellor Tim White's 2017 executive order that eliminated remedial education put the 23 campuses in high gear to overhaul math and English classes. The math changes are further along. Cal State Long Beach Dean Curtis Bennett says some university educators warned that the changes would set students up to fail.
And we don't see that at all. We see, in fact, that when we tailor the classes more to the students' needs and we tailor the classes to thinking about communication and being engaging, the students are doing just as well or, quite frankly, even better.
The Cal State Chancellor's Office is pushing campuses hard to improve math classes and raise graduation rates. 3 years ago, 59% of first-time students system-wide earned their degrees in 6 years. A new initiative aims to raise that rate to 70% by 2025. And as with most things education, socioeconomics plays a role. The Cal State campuses that are showing the most success in raising graduation rates, San Diego and Long Beach, have lower enrollment rates of low-income and minority students. Cal State Northridge enrolls a lot of low-income students. Administrators there say they are still fine-tuning math classes to allow more students to succeed. Elizabeth Adams, the Associate Vice President of Undergraduate Studies at Northridge, says about 30% of first-year students needing remedial help pass their math requirement in their first year.
We have a ways to go. I mean, that's not good. That's not enough.
Northridge is working on changing its statistics and algebra classes to make them more engaging for students. More needs to be done to bring campus educators around to this new way of approaching students, says Christopher Nellum, a higher education researcher with the Education Trust West.
I think that work, that sort of changing the narrative and changing folks' hearts and minds, was also equally challenging for the system, and I think that work is still happening.
Sarah Martinette's heart and mind are changed. The sophomore plans to use her newfound math skills and confidence to pursue her dream job at the FBI.
I am a criminal justice major, and I am not 100% sure what I would like to do with that yet, but maybe law, maybe federal government.
And she plans on graduating in 4 years. That's good for her and good for Cal State. Covering higher education, I'm Adolfo Guzman Lopez.
All right, let's make a hard turn now to one of the hardest roads in Southern California to make turns, exits, and entrances, the 110, aka the Arroyo Seco Parkway. Caltrans is well aware of its reputation for being hard to merge onto and off of. Now it's studying ways to make that freeway safer for motorists. Now they're proposing 5 different options, and yes, doing nothing is one of them. Let's hear about the other 4 from 2 people behind the study. Abdi Sagafi is Office Chief for Transportation for Traffic Operations, and Jason Roach is the Senior Environmental Planner for the project. Thanks to you both for making the time.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
All right, you both play an important part in determining what needs to be done with the 110 freeway, but at the heart of whatever happens next is absolute safety. Now, Abdi, let's start with you. People who've driven the 110 are more familiar with its shortcomings, but tell us about the problems you hope to solve at the end of your study.
The short on and off ramp lengths, they're very sharp turns, and it's difficult for the drivers to negotiate the turns when exiting or entering the parkway. The other problems, of course, is the number of lanes and the usage of those lanes during peak hours. And, of course, the geometry of the parkway is outdated. There's not much room to expand or widen. So, therefore, we have to work within the current geometry and make improvements to improve safety and operation.
And Jason, as the environmental planner on this project, you are concerned with the environmental impact, but another consideration that people might not think about when it comes to the 110 is historic preservation. So remind us of the history of the freeway and how that history affects your choices going forward.
That's right. It was built in 1940. We have to maintain the historical integrity of the resource. We're in charge of it. We own it. And it presents a lot of challenges because no matter what we do out there, it's going to have some adverse effect. And so now, you know, we're almost in 2020 now, and speeds out there have really gone through the roof, and we now have people driving on there unsafely. And we're trying to do something about managing driver behavior out there, which is very challenging.
Okay, let's get to the options because, well, one of the options, the first one, is leave things the way they are. Second one is something called hard shoulder running. What is hard shoulder running, Abdi?
It's just a fancy term for using the outside lane as a shoulder during off-peak hours. But during peak hours, when the capacity is needed, that outside lane will become a lane.
And Abdi, the next one is called dynamic flex. What is dynamic flex?
Dynamic flex lane is slightly different than hard shoulder running. The outside lane will also be used as a shoulder. However, the shoulder will be used for drivers to get off and get on the parkway more safely.
All right, now, speed reduction is another possibility you're considering. How big of a factor does speed play in accidents on a freeway like the 110?
Reducing the speed may sound like a good alternative, mm-hmm. but it will definitely create some more congestion because the vehicles are required to go slower. Furthermore, the speeds on this parkway have increased over the years. The observed speeds when we did the last speed zone survey was in the range of 60 to 65 miles per hour, which is way over the current speed limit. So we can have speed limit signs and such, but Ultimately, it's up to the drivers to honor those speed limits.
What would the speed go down to? What's being proposed?
If that alternative is pursued, it would go down to 45 miles an hour.
Well, 45, if someone aims for 45 and it winds up being 55, I mean, at least that would be an improvement.
Yes, but this is a commuter route. So the folks who live in Pasadena, South Pasadena, and Points North drive this route every day. They believe that they know every curve and every corner, and they speed. So the only thing we can do, enforcement, is where it all comes down to.
All right, Abdi, one last possibility you're considering is the two-lane option. Explain the two-lane option.
We will completely remove the third lane out of the equation. It will become a permanent shoulder. We'll only have two-lane travel lanes during peak and off-peak. The net result of that is reduced capacity. So that's going to cause even more congestion. However, in order not to leave any stone unturned, we have to look at all the possible solutions that may work on this parkway. And that's why this option was chosen to be considered.
Talking to Abdi Sagafi, Caltrans Office Chief for Traffic Operations, and Jason Roach, Senior Environmental Planner for the project. Jason, coming back to you, I know historical integrity is important when it comes to changing the 110, but I can already hear people, Jason, say, why should that matter when we're talking about life and death here? What would you say to them?
I drive the Arroyo also all the time, and it's a great resource, and it's something that I think that we can maintain. If we could just manage these speeds, manage the actual flow, and make it a safer resource, we'll be able to maintain the historical integrity of this resource. If we go through this process, you know, this is a two-year environmental process that we're just starting, and it turns out that none of these alternatives are going to make it safer, we'll have to revisit some other options, but what we don't want to do is degrade the facility to such a point that it's no longer, it loses all of its historical integrity.
Abdi, can there be a combination of one and maybe one other? Say, speed reduction is one, and then choosing either dynamic flex or hard shoulder running. Could that be something that is chosen as well?
Oh, definitely. We're definitely open to any of those combinations. We will definitely look at the possibility of combining options. That's definitely on the table.
And Jason, as far as a timeline, when could we start to see the results of the study? And is there a way for people to weigh in?
We have a meeting next Monday at the Ramona Community Hall in the city of Los Angeles, right off the Arroyo. People can weigh in on these ideas. Right now, that's all they are. We haven't studied these yet. We're just starting it. And the first step of the process is to take it to the public and say, hey, these are ideas to improve safety on the parkway, and let people weigh in on their opinions, on the ideas. We don't expect to choose a preferred alternative for about 2 years from now. And then we're going to go ahead and study it, present all of the environmental impacts to the public, and then they'll have another opportunity to comment on our study. And then after all of that is done, we will choose one of these alternatives.
Jason Roach and Abdi Sagafi are with the California Department of Transportation. They're studying ways to make State Route 110 safer. Jason, Abdi, thanks a lot for making the time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, you got climate change questions, I've got climate change answers. Well, not me personally, because I'm just a radio guy. No. Instead, we called a couple of Caltech scientists who are going to answer things such as what percentage of climate change is natural versus man-made, or if scientists could make government change or enact three laws to reduce our impact on the climate, what would they be? Find out the answers when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. Leaders from more than 60 countries gathered today in New York for the United Nations Summit on Climate Change, although our own president did not stay for much of it, according to reports. Earlier, Swedish teen climate activist Greta Thunberg had this message for attendees.
The eyes of all future generations are upon you. And if you choose to fail us, I say we will never forgive you.
The UN has called climate change the defining issue of our time. And here at KPCC, we spent a lot of time last week talking about it and what can be done to mitigate its effects and adapt to them. It was part of a global initiative with more than 200 other media outlets called Covering Climate Now. And throughout the week, we heard from many of you who said you'd like more of this kind of coverage. So today, we answer some questions that listeners sent us asking about different aspects of climate change. To help us out with a few of them, we called up a couple of people at California Institute of Technology, First up is Tapio Schneider, Professor of Environmental Science and Engineering. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right, we received a lot of questions last week, and we selected a few to answer on air today. So we're going to start with some Climate Change 101. Professor Tapio Schneider, here's the question. What percentage of climate change is natural versus man-made?
I would say if you look at the long-term trend, say it's these 2.5 degrees of warming we've had over land over the last century, that's 100% man-made. If you look at shorter-term trends, fluctuations on timescales of decades, there's a good bit of natural variations in that as well.
Professor, since the research clearly shows that climate change is due to what human beings have been doing over the years, do you feel as if the message is being heard loudly and clearly enough?
20 years ago or so, it was possible to think that climate change is something that happens in a distant future. We need not worry much about it. But now it's here. We feel it. We see it. It affects us every day. And it is becoming impossible to ignore. And I think people are realizing that. The question is the policy world realizing it to the degree it should and acting the way it should? Well, the answer is probably no. I mean, we could do more than we are doing there.
You mentioned policymakers. There are leaders all over the world gathering today. What would you tell them, Professor?
I agree with the message that is coming from a lot of the activists. It's time to act on climate change. And what this means is, I think you want to use market instruments to incentivize economic transitions. You probably would like to have some price on carbon that will help incentivize renewable energy sources becoming more prominent in the market than they are right now. And that's where we have to go. At the same time, it's an enormous opportunity for an advanced economy to lead in what will be the market of the future.
All right. Next question comes from Paul Jenkin in Ventura. And this is the question. What is the real threat of sea level rise? How are predictions lining up with reality?
The real threat of sea level rise is that whatever sea level rise you get, it adds, for example, to storm surges. So if you take Superstorm Sandy that flooded New York, it had a 13-foot storm surge, and that was devastating for New York City, the Eastern Seaboard. If you just add, say, a 2-foot sea level rise on top of whatever storm surge you get, you can get a devastation like what Superstorm Sandy caused with just an 11-foot storm surge that gets you to the 13-foot that Sandy had. And I think that's where the real danger of sea level rise comes from. Additionally, if you think about, say, beaches around here that can be quite narrow, can be quite shallow, 1 or 2 feet of sea level rise can be enough to wipe out those beaches and lead to coastal erosion and threaten coastal properties.
All right, now to a question that came to us all the way from Colorado. And here's the question.
Has the melting of the permafrost and the related methane emissions from this melting been accurately assessed in greenhouse gas inventories and accounted for in global temperature increase predictions?
So far, it has been a relatively minor source of methane compared to wetlands and animal husbandry and the like. In the future, that can become a large source, and it's a difficult source to assess because it involves intricate details of soil microbiology. You need to understand what soil microbes will do to the methane. They can also take up methane. And the question is how much of the methane that could potentially be released as the permafrost thaws. And we don't quite know the answer to that question.
Yeah, it sounds like that would be a hard one to pin down.
It is very hard. It just involves interactions of the physics, ice thawing, the clouds over the poles, how they affect the surface climate, and then the whole microbiology of soils. You have to get all of that right altogether to predict such things accurately, and that's hard.
All right, Professor Schneider, we have one more question. This one from Candace Border. She sent us this question from Orange County.
Besides the military, what other industries or corporations are quietly planning for sea level rise and more extreme weather?
Lots of industries are planning to adapt to changing climates, to sea level rise, extreme weather. There's the insurance industry. The reinsurance industry is very well aware of the risks and planning for the risks. Catastrophe risk assessment plays an increasingly large role in financial markets. Portfolio managers like to assess the risk from climate change to their portfolios and are trying to quantify, for example, what their exposure is to climate risks, such as sea level rise, to the real estate that's embedded in their portfolios. I think in the future, we'll see lots and lots more interest and attempts to quantify risks from climate change in many aspects of the economy, because it will affect essentially all aspects of the economy.
That's Tapio Schneider, Professor of Environmental Science and Engineering at Caltech. Professor, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
All right, now we turn to Linka Novak, postdoctoral scholar in atmospheric dynamics at Caltech, and she joins us now to answer a few more of your questions about climate change. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
All right, so this first question for you comes from LA resident Sean Wright.
When I was younger in the 90s and the early 2000s, I would hear a lot about the ozone layer and ozone depletion, but I never hear about it now. I'm just wondering, is there a particular reason why?
Yeah, so the reason why we have stopped hearing about it is because we've kind of done what's necessary to stop making it worse. I mean, that doesn't mean that the problem isn't there anymore. I mean, it's still very large. But we have now identified what the ozone hole is, how we need to deal with it, and we have taken actions. So we stopped releasing the chemicals that make it, that trigger it. But the problem is that these chemicals, the CFCs, they have a very long lifetime of several decades. So we're looking at 2060, maybe 2080, until there is some recovery.
So is it pretty much about the aerosol cans, Linka? Because I remember when I was a kid hearing about how this ozone layer would all of a sudden be melted away and the sun would just fry us up. So I was legitimately scared back when I was a teenager. Is it just all because of the aerosol cans?
Yeah, aerosol and what you use in refrigerators. So what we use were these chlorofluorocarbons. And the important chemical is called chlorine. And that's really what causes these reactions to destroy the ozone.
So to be clear, because we took action, now the problem is on its way to not being as dire as it seemed.
Yes, this is one of the most successful cases of scientists and governments really working together.
All right, Linka, this next question comes from Eric Anderson up near Petaluma in Northern California.
Who is the worst CO2 polluter in the world today? And what are their projected pollution contributions into the future? And what can the United States do about that?
In terms of total emissions, China, India, USA, Russia, and Europe are the biggest polluters. But I think a more fair way of looking at these statistics is to look at the emissions per person. And when you look at those, China and India are way lower on that list. And countries in Europe, like Germany and the USA, they are on top of that list. Unfortunately, the USA is near the top of both those lists. So it's not only one of the major total emission contributors, but also per person. So I think the solution for that is to lead by example. After all, we have some of the top scientists and engineers in the world who should be able to deal with the problems that we're facing today.
All right, this last question for you is from Steve Holtzman in Los Angeles. And it's a timely one, given that world leaders have gathered in New York today for a United Nations summit on climate change. And here's the question. If scientists could make government change or enact three laws to reduce our impact on the climate, what would they be?
I can only speak for myself, but to me, there are three main areas that should be targeted. There's the direct emission of fossil fuels. There's the incentivizing, making and using clean technologies, and education. So in terms of the direct legislative limit on emissions, I think a good example is what California is already doing. So it has a scheme where they cap the amount of carbon that can be released, and each company seems to have an allowance and of the carbon that can be released. And if they don't release it, they can trade that excess allowance to other companies. And I think a law that can make this nationwide would be Brilliant. So the next one was the incentivizing making and using clean technologies. So I think Tesla is a good example. So kind of making those companies, kind of supporting them. So I think you could also apply a similar business model to efficient buildings and similar products. And lastly, in terms of the education, I think it's really important to incorporate the climate change facts, the most recent discoveries in school curricula, so that people know what climate change means to them personally, and so that they know where to find out the information that gives them that information. I mean, there are already several websites, such as NOAA, NASA, the IPCC, where you can find this information. But I get the impression that a lot of people rely on just headlines from the media, which can be confusing. And I've been there. Before I came into the field, I was also a bit confused, but I know where people are coming from. I really think that if you want to know the truth, look at the facts and look at the science. So I think it's also important to encourage scientists to get involved in government policy. For example, have scientists on the U.S. Senate Science Committee. And that way, just like we did with the ozone hole, the two-way conversation between governments and scientists will be much more effective, and we will be able to deal with these problems in a way that makes sense both economically and also environmentally.
That was Lenka Novak, postdoctoral scholar in atmospheric dynamics at Caltech, answering some of your questions about climate change. Lenka, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
All right, you can find out more information relating to all of these questions on KPCC's website, laist.com. That's laist.com. All right, typically we wait until Friday to give you a list of stuff to do for the weekend, but there's an exhibit at LACMA that checks a lot of to-do list boxes. Great for adults, great for kids, combines Japanese art with all kinds of animals. We sent someone to check it all out. We're going to hear all about it when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. If you like science fiction, this is probably a familiar image.
Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination.
From monstrous reptiles and dragons to elephants, tigers, and monkeys, creatures of all stripes have played an important role in Japanese culture for centuries. And a new exhibition devoted to that relationship just opened this past weekend at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. It's called Every Living Thing, Animals in Japanese Art. And Take-Two contributor Beto Arcos went to check it out.
Curator Robert Singer says the idea for this exhibition came from a friend, art historian Itoshiro. As the story goes, when Shiro walked into the Pavilion for Japanese Art at LACMA some 11 years ago to view the collection, he jokingly said,
"This is not the Japanese Pavilion of Art at LACMA. This is the Japanese Zoo."
That's Singer recounting the story. He's been curator of Japanese art at LACMA for 31 years.
He said, "Look, that's an animal. That sculpture is an animal. The Haniwa horse we're looking at now. There's a Haniwa dog. There's a painting of a tiger." And I'm going, everything I'm looking at is animals, ceramics, lacquer, paintings, prints. And I go, nobody ever mentioned that. 20 years I'd been here. 20 years. He said, there's animals. You've got animals in all forms of Japanese art. So you have to do a big show. I said, great, I'll do a big show.
The big show was first on view this past summer at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. Last Friday, it opened at LACMA's Resnik Pavilion. There are 200 works of art, all referencing different creatures. Dogs, tigers, cats, birds, insects, fireflies, wild boar, dragons, you name it. One is a painting from the 17th century called Shakyamuni Passing into Nirvana. Singer describes a scene detailed at the bottom of the hanging silk scroll.
And all the animals, those beautiful animals at the bottom, they're all crying. The elephant is distraught. The fish are coming out of the sea. They're all crying and weeping, thinking that the great Buddha, they think he's dying. He is leaving his earthly body, but he's going into nirvana. Only in Japan do you get all these animals lamenting the loss of the Buddha.
Singer says the Japanese have a special reverence and affection for animals, stemming from the Chinese zodiac that so many Asian countries have embraced. Here in the Western world, we have 12 months. But in Japan and China, it's a 12-year calendar, and each year is associated with an animal, starting with the rat, followed by the ox, tiger, rabbit, dragon, snake, horse, goat, monkey, rooster, and wild boar. He shows me a chart on the wall with all the animals of the zodiac. I tell him I'm a tiger.
So look, you're sensitive, you're stubborn, you could be short-tempered, you're courageous, and you're sympathetic and empathetic. See, that describes you. So I want people, when they come, to find out what animal they are and then identify with their own animal and look for their own. Children love this. They'll say, oh, you're a horse, you know. Find the horses in the show.
Singer says this is an accessible show meant for everyone.
It's just so much fun. It's educational. You learn about Buddhism. You learn about Shinto. You learn about folklore and Japanese art, and it's a win-win.
The exhibition is divided into different sections covering various themes of Japanese culture. In the Zen section of the show, Singer describes a painting of a monkey perched on a rock, his hand reaching down to touch the water.
The idea is that's the moon reflected in the water. He thinks he's touching the moon, but it's a reflection of the moon. So he thinks he's reaching for the truth, but he's reaching for it's unreachable. And it's a beautiful painting, very early, 500 years ago, that painting, very rare painting.
We are very glad to show to the people in the United States, and especially Los Angeles and Southern California at large, where the Japanese culture is a big deal.
Hideki Hara is director of the Japan Foundation Los Angeles, a co-organizer of the exhibition. LA is home to the second largest population of Japanese in the U.S., so Hara says the show's connection to the city cannot be underestimated.
We have Japanese Americans, and we have a long tradition of being good friends with the Japan. And so we are very glad to have this wide breadth of arts on the theme of animals to the people here.
Hara says this exhibition will help people in Los Angeles learn more about the complexity and richness of Japanese culture. For Robert Singer's part, he wants everyone to see the beauty and joy, the humor and the reverence the Japanese have for the many creatures of the earth, and how Japanese artists make them come alive. For Take Two, I'm Beto Arcos.
We're going to take a minute here to give props to the staff. Our producers are Lori Skywalker-Galaretta and Leo Duran. Austin Cross, more often than not, directs the show. Tamika Adams is our news apprentice. Our editor is Sue Carpenter, program engineered by Hazamik Pogosian, and Megan Larson is the senior producer. If you missed any part of Take Two today, just go to wherever you get your podcast. Just look for us, Take Two. There we will be waiting to be heard by your ears. Plus, we're also on social media as well. Just go to @Take2. That's @Take2 on Twitter. And I'm there on Twitter and Instagram @AMartinezLA. That's @AMartinezLA. That's good for both of them for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.